The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Tonight I was thinking of sharing some Dharma poetry with you. The Buddha actually spoke in poetry quite a bit. He seemed to be talented at poetry. And it said, you know, from people who understand the Pali, they say that he really had a way with playing with words and using puns and also, you know, using the way the phrases were juxtaposed to create different meaning and analogies and images, and all of that gets lost in translation. So, you know, this poem, it sounds pretty, like, I don't know, it doesn't have a lot of poetic feeling to it in some ways. And yet, at the same time, this poem that I chose to share tonight, in one of the texts, in one of the Buddhist texts, it's the Majjhima Nikaya. This poem is referred to four different times. And the references, the first time is the Buddha offering this poem as a teaching, and then elaborating on it as a teaching, which is kind of what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to read the poem, and then we're going to kind of go through it and explore what is the teaching understanding of this poem. So the first one is the Buddha offering this poem and then elaborating on it as a teaching. And the next one is one of his attendant, Ananda, who had a very good memory. Basically, I guess one time when the Buddha was away, Ananda gave a memorized exposition of what the Buddha said in that previous one. So it's identical. It's an identical text, only it says that Ananda said it. And then in the third one, there seems to be this conversation, or actually what it is there's somebody who has this image or a vision of a deity who comes to this bhikkhu, this monk, and says, "Do you remember that poem, A Single Excellent Night," which is the title of the poem? And the bhikkhu says, "No, I don't remember it. Do you remember it?" And the deity says, "No, I don't remember it either. Maybe we should go find out what it is." And so they go to the Buddha, and the Buddha tells them the poem, but then goes off and meditates himself, so he doesn't elaborate. And so they ask another monk to elaborate. And so you get a different teaching. It's a slightly different elaboration, covering some of the same terrain. But, you know, and actually this monk said, "Well, here's the exploration or the exposition of this poem as I understand it." So he doesn't say, "This is what the Buddha said." He said, "This is how I understand it." And that's very much what I'm going to be offering you tonight. This is my understanding. And then the fourth one is kind of similar, that you know, two people are talking, or again, I think it's a deity, and they say, "Do you remember this?" "No, I don't remember this. Maybe we should go find somebody." And so three of them are kind of, or two of them in particular, are, "Do you remember this poem?" "No, I don't remember it." "Well, it's a good poem to remember, so let's go get the teaching about it again." It gave me a sense that this poem was used to memorize, essentially, as a kind of a teaching poem. And then you memorize the poem and then understand the meaning of it. And then some of the phrases of the poem might come back to you in your meditation, and some of the understanding that it represented might come back to you. So it seemed to me, since it appeared four times, and it's actually one of the, there's not that many teachings like that. I mean, there's a lot of repetition in the sutta, but for a particular specific teaching to be referred to, "Do you remember the Buddhist teaching on this poem?" Or, "Do you remember this particular thing?" As to be quoted. That doesn't happen that often. So it seems like it feels to me like it is asking to be remembered. So I thought I would share it with you. So I'll just read the poem at first. And this is coming from the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the main translators of the Pali texts. But I have edited this for gender neutrality. A single excellent night. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. Let them know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep death away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is that one, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night. So, kind of line at a time, let not a person revive the past. So what does that mean? I mean, we all do this, actually. This is a, and we all are familiar with what this means. When I start exploring it, I think you'll all have a sense of a familiarity of what this means. So in the the description what the Buddha gave, where he talked about what this means, he pointed to it not just being that we think thoughts about the past, because that's we're going to be doing that. That's going to happen. But that somehow we're caught in them. Somehow we are attached to them. We can kind of take up. It's almost like we create a world with our thoughts about something that happened in the past. And we are reliving that experience. Is this familiar? Do you have a sense of what I'm talking about? I mean, this kind of thing happens to us a lot. We sit here thinking, ruminating about something that happened in the past. And we are, not only are we thinking about it, but we're also kind of living it again. When thoughts arise, often a lot of emotions come up with it. And we almost believe, it's like we take birth or take up residence in a world that's created by our minds about the past. And in that, we're losing touch with what's actually happening here and now. Often. Not always. It's definitely possible to think about the past and not lose touch with the present moment. Because what is a thought about the past? It's something, it's a phenomenon, it's an arising of a thought in the present moment with content that is connected to something that happened to us in our past. And so the thought itself is happening now. It's arising right now. And so, but we don't notice that. We don't notice it as something that's arising right now because we are, instead of recognizing that this thought is something, oh, this is a thought about the past and this is happening right now, we instead pick up the content of that thought and like we take birth in that content. We create a thought bubble or a thought world with that content. Now, the Buddha says, let not a person revive the past. And so it's possible to remember the past and not take up that kind of residence that kind of residence in that thought, but actually recognize, oh yeah, that happened. And actually it's good to remember that because it helps me with what I need to do next. So that's kind of how thoughts of the past can be useful. We need thoughts. We need thoughts to navigate our lives. And so to me, this teaching, and as I said, this is Andrea's understanding of this teaching, we need thoughts to navigate our lives. And so this teaching here is not saying stop thinking. But what it's pointing to is perhaps a specific kind of relationship to thinking that tends to not be so helpful. A relationship to thinking that has this kind of gripping to it. And in fact, in the exploration or the exposition about this part of the teaching, it points to craving and clinging around those thoughts. In one place it says, you know, there's a thought arises in the mind about something that happened in the past, and one thinks, oh, wasn't that delightful? Delight and kind of craving springs up for that existed in the past. And so this is actually one way that we revive the past, that we remember something pleasant that happened, and we think back about it and think, oh, wasn't that great? And we kind of just get lost in the fantasy of that delight or something, instead of actually being here now. This actually is a strategy we sometimes use when things now are difficult or something's happening that's challenging. One strategy might be remembering something from the past, you know, kind of remembering, oh, wasn't that so great then? It can be helpful to kind of create a little bit of ease in the moment, and yet it's not addressing what's happening now. And so it is kind of a stepping out of the present moment when we do that, when we take up residence in those thoughts. So that's one way that we revive the past. We revive a pleasant sense of the past. But this craving that the Buddha points to about the craving being the piece, the relationship to those thoughts that's problematic, that craving doesn't just take the form of looking for pleasantness. Because our minds also do something like this, and this is one I'm really familiar with, is thinking back on what happened in the past and remembering when things went wrong and trying to figure out how I could have not done that. So kind of thinking about the past and trying to figure out, well, that was awful, and maybe I should have done this, or maybe I should have done this, or what if I hadn't done that? If only I hadn't done that, then everything now would be so different. And so we revive the past in that way, trying in a way in our minds to revise the past. You know, like we want to go back and change the past through our thoughts about it. Figure out how could that have been different. And I've seen my mind do this, you know. It will get stuck in this whirl, berating myself about things I did, if I'd only done this or if I'd only done that, instead of living in the present moment where I have some say and stepping forward from this moment, instead of spinning in that world of, well, if only I'd done this, or if only I'd done that. Well, here are the consequences of having done that. What can I do now? And so I think very much, you know, this, in some ways, I think this teaching, it really just points us right into the present moment. You know, it's asking us to remember that, as it says, that the past has been left behind and the future's not been reached. Where we have a choice about where we can act, the only place we have a choice about where we can act is right now in this present moment. We can't act in the past. We can't act in the future. We can act now. We will act in the past, and we did act in the future, but that's not here right now. And so this is the place where we have the choice in this moment. And so we revive the past through bringing up thoughts about the past that are pleasant and kind of living in that world of pleasant. Sometimes we revive the past thinking we'll revise it because it's unpleasant. So often, I'd say, when we're reviving the past, there is often an emotional charge connected with that. And so that might be a clue, you know, that when you're thinking about the past and there's an emotional charge, there's a way in which you've taken up some residence there. You know, you have kind of taken up birth. You've created that bubble and kind of started living in it. So if you're thinking about the past and there's strong emotional charge, it's probably time to start just being with that, paying attention. And this is what we explore. We explore the possibility of, in this moment, given what's happened, and I'll get to this sentence in a moment, but I'm pointing to it here. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. And so thoughts have arisen. We've gotten caught in those thoughts, and thoughts of the past. We've revived the past, and yet now we've become aware, and we see, wow, there's a lot of reactivity here. Now, this teaching then points us to is not that we can somehow go do it over and not revive the past, but that we can wake up to, here's the experience now in this moment, this present moment experience of having done that, of having revived the past. Wow, right here, right now, I'm feeling this frustration, this confusion, this anger, this desire. So feeling into that now, this is opening to seeing the presently arisen state right now. So often I'd say when we revive the past, there is some kind of an emotional charge. And yet not always. It can be kind of surprising, actually, sometimes. I'll tell you how I saw this. I'll give you the first time I saw this very clearly, and often the first time we see something clearly, that kind of gets seared on your brain. And so, you know, this one is seared on my brain. It's one of those, it's like, wow, that was pretty interesting. So kind of a little bit of context. I had been in a long relationship with somebody, and they had broken up with me, and couple years, you know, of working with the feelings around that, the anger, the oh, woe is me, the why me, you know, all of the feelings associated with the thoughts, the reviving the past around the relationship, basically. So a lot of that had been going on for quite some time. And a lot of work. I explored, okay, oh, here I revived the past. Can I be with this presently arisen state? I did a lot of that. Oh, anger. Can I be with this anger? Anger was the big one that came up around this particular breakup. And so, you know, a lot of that, the past was revived, but then I woke up. It's like, okay, yep, can I be with this? Can I feel into this experience of the anger? And so I've been working with that for a couple of years, and largely the reactivity around that relationship was gone. There wasn't a lot of reactivity, and so you know, previously when I'd been thinking thoughts, when thoughts about that relationship had come up, there was the reactivity that was born, and then I'd wake up and work with that reactivity. But at some point, it started happening that the mind would be thinking thoughts about the past in regard to this relationship, and then I would wake up and I would not have the emotional reactivity, but I would recognize, so it wasn't like I was sitting there thinking, oh, this is a big problem, and oh, I'm so angry at that person. I didn't have any of that, but what I recognized was that the mind had believed, while it was thinking about that relationship, the mind had believed it was back in the relationship. And when I woke up, it was like, what? Wait, no, wait, I'm not in relationship with that person. What? What's going on? So there was confusion when I woke up. And that confusion was clear, I think, partly because the reactivity was gone. And so it just became very clear that the mind had believed the thoughts. That these thoughts about the past, like, oh yeah, we did this kind of thing and we're going to do this kind of thing. It's like the mind was doing its remembering and planning thing around the relationship. And when I woke up, it was like, that was all completely constructed by the mind. And the mind believed it. And I happened to be walking with a friend. And, you know, and I told my friend what had happened, and she said, oh, that sounds like it would be very painful. I said, no, it wasn't at all painful. It was just really confusing. How could the mind believe that? So this kind of belief, you know, that we do this a lot, But partly because we're living, our thoughts are about things that are kind of roughly what's going on in our lives, we don't notice that we've taken up residence in those thoughts and believed them as some inherent reality when they're really just thoughts and constructions in our mind. And so this was an example where I could clearly see, because it was no longer the true reality of this present moment, it was clear to me that my mind had believed something that was completely deluded. And so I think this kind of thing happens a lot. And this too is reviving the past. This kind of, you know, taking up the thoughts as if they are real. That's a kind of a way that we could say reviving the past. So taking up thoughts of the past as if they are real now. So a lot of suffering, struggle can happen through this process. I mean, that example, it wasn't terribly suffering in the way of, you know, because I wasn't reacting to the content, but often we do react to the content of our thoughts. We have a thought about something that happened and we relive the suffering of that moment sometimes. And also that kind of coming into the world of that thought, we are not in the present moment reality. So we are essentially missing our lives and missing the opportunity to make skillful choices in this moment. When we're lost in reviving the past, we are missing many, many moments of times when we could be choosing to do something to lead our life forward in a helpful way. And so we're really missing a big opportunity when we buy into this kind of habit of mind. And it is a habit. And the fact that the Buddha could describe this 2,600 years ago points to the fact that this is, you are not alone. We are not alone in this habit of reviving the past. It is a human propensity. It's a thing that humans do. And yet here the Buddha is pointing out, check this out. Look at what happens when you revive the past. Is it helpful? Does it really serve you? Or is it more helpful to be aware of the thoughts about the past happening in the present moment so that you can respond skillfully in the present moment to that content? That's a different thing. That's a completely different thing, to be aware of a thought that's happening while it's happening, understand the content, and then understand, oh, this is how that knowledge of the past can be used now. It's a very different relationship to thought from the past. And then the next one. So let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. That one sounds a little harder to let go of. Where else do we build our hopes if not on the future? And yet, thoughts of the future, you know, even when we're thinking about thoughts of the future, about isn't it going to be great when something happens, you know, those thoughts are, again, they're just something that's happening right now. It's a thought that's happening right now. And it is, I mean, thoughts of the past at least have some bearing on, often, at least sometimes you can have thoughts that, like, you know, we not only revive the past, we revise, we make up a different, an alternative past. But much of the time our memory is what, when we think the things of the past, there's some relationship. It has some bearing on who we are and what happened to us. So there's some connection with something that happened at some point, often, when we think about the past. It may not be a perfectly accurate representation of that past event, but there's some connection with something that happened. The future, those thoughts, those are just completely made up. We can have no idea about how the future will unfold. And any ideas that we create in our minds, It's just a construction of mind. So it is whole, it is made up out of whole cloth. It is just a construction of our minds. Now, it may be, you know, in terms of the way our minds work, it may be related to or very similar to things that we've seen unfolding in our lives before, and so we can think. So, for instance, right now I could say, I am going to reach and pick up that glass of water. And it happens. So I planned. Fortunately, I didn't pin my hopes on it. But, you know, I planned. We can plan. There is a way that we can think. Our minds are built to model the future. I mean, this is a function of being human. It's a great function, actually. It's one of the things that makes us human, that we can play a scenario out in our minds and consider what the consequences of that would be. Reflect on those consequences. Think about which choice might be a skillful choice. So it's a function of our minds, again, that's useful, and not one here that I think the Buddha is saying, don't think about the future. But I think he wants us to be aware, when we are thinking about the future, of what it is. That it is a thought arising in the present moment, and that it is a kind of a, well, it's a model, or it's a kind of a thought moving in that direction, but it's not something upon which to kind of like, you know, like again, like take up residence in that thought as if it were true and say, yes, that is where I have to go. In order for my happiness to follow, that is this future scenario that has to unfold. And that's kind of pinning your hopes on that scenario. I mean, even this decision to pick up my glass, I can plan to do that. There needs to be a little bit of a plan or an intention, a thought to do that. But between the time that that intention arises and the time that I reach for the glass, I really have no idea what is going to unfold. In a very real way, I mean, we do not know what the very next moment will bring. And we see this actually, you know, all the time if you read the news, how somebody is asleep in their apartment building and the apartment goes up in flames. Or people are going to work at their office building, at the UPS yesterday. Four people lose their lives at their normal place of work. They didn't go planning that would be their last day of life. So, in a very real way, we have no idea what will unfold. And so if we are pinning our hopes on a particular outcome, then we're living in a kind of a delusional world, or we're living in a world where, you know, sometimes those things can come, they can follow, but to say this has to happen, this is the scenario that has to unfold in order for me to be okay, that is kind of setting ourselves up for suffering. So again, similar to reviving the past, there's different ways we build our hopes on the future. Sometimes, or building the hopes, that phrase again implies thinking thoughts of pleasant futures in a way. And yet, I've seen myself take birth in the future, not in a pleasant way, but more like, it's more like the mind can, through this method that it has to figure out, well, that could happen, and that could happen, and that could happen. It's like my mind would like proliferate the 20 things that could happen and try to figure out, follow all of those threads, and if that one happens, then that's the thing I need to do. If that one happens, then that's the thing I need to do. And a lot of this planning for the future, trying to avoid some unpleasant consequence, at least in my own experience, a lot of this is about worry and anxiety. This futurizing sometimes can be disasterizing. We disasterize. And the if there's emotional reactivity, again, the emotional reactivity is a kind of clue for us. If we're thinking thoughts about the future and having emotional reactivity, it's probably a clue that we are kind of picking it up as some kind of reality. Because it's just a thought in our minds. It's just an idea in our minds. At one point, with a relationship, the same relationship that ended, but this was before it ended, and before I even started practicing, but at some point I started my mind doing something like imagining things that my partner might do, and then getting mad at my partner. Because, well, it was something that he might have done, that he might have done, so it was like in the realm of what my partner might have done. So, and I recognized, it's like, well, that didn't happen. But still, the anger was there. And so if you're finding yourself thinking thoughts about the future and feeling an emotional response, that's probably a time to bring it back to, oh, okay, that has arisen because I essentially built hope on the future, although that phraseology might not be quite right, but believed that future thought, believed it to have a reality, essentially. I think that's what it's saying here, that building hopes on the future is taking the thoughts that are happening in the present moment to have a reality, to have some kind of an existence to it. Kind of like with the thoughts of the past. It's like we believe there's a reality to them. So often with thoughts of the future, that happens too. So again, the encouragement might be not to try to stop thinking thoughts about the future, but to see, can you be aware of thoughts about the future? Recognize that it can be valuable to think thoughts about the future, but what can be valuable about that? And this I see actually in my own exploration of reflecting on future ideas. It's like, oh, I could do that. As I think about that, I feel something. It's like because the thinking about doing something creates something in our brain as if we are doing it, we can feel a response. And so thinking, okay, maybe I'll do that. And how does that feel? Well, maybe I can do that. Well, how does that feel? And is there a constriction in the heart around that, or is there kind of a feeling of peace around that? And so you can use the awareness in the present moment when thinking thoughts about the future to make some skillful choices, to use that as information. How you are in the present moment as you think those thoughts is useful information in terms of making choices. And so again, coming back into the present around it. The other piece I wanted to share from my own experience around the planning thoughts for the future. At some point, I began getting very curious. I think this happened more after I started practicing about this pattern that I had to just, proliferate into the different choices that would be possible. Well, if that happens, I'll do that and that. And if that happens, I'll do that and that. If that happens, I'll do that and that. Coming up with what I thought would be the possible futures and planning how I was going to respond in all the situations. And then I began to recognize that most of the time, none of those happened. None of them were even close to what actually unfolded. And so I wasted all that time thinking about something that never happened. So that was one thing I began to realize, is that a lot of this projection into the future was not very useful. I began to realize it was not very useful. And then I realized at some point that even if my mind had created the scenario and recognized, oh, that could happen, and that thing unfolded, I had this great plan in my mind. It's like, well, if that happens, then this is what I'm going to say, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to be. Almost never could I be that way or say that thing or do that thing. So those plans I mean, it's like something else was going on that I didn't anticipate in that, that completely shifted the terrain and either made those things not relevant or just drove them out of my mind because that other thing was more present, more palpable, something more up in that situation. And so as I began reflecting on that, I saw, wow, this habit is not very useful. And so I just began to be more interested in seeing the habit rather than believing the habit was something that I needed to do. And so it began to weaken. It began to become less of a predominant pattern. So the next part, instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. I'm going to take this in two parts because let them see each presently arisen state. I've talked about this a little bit in looking at what's happening as we're thinking thoughts of the past or thinking thoughts of the future. If we can come in and recognize, oh, this thought, this is actually happening right now. This is a different approach. This is a different way of relating to thoughts of the past and the future, or relating to experience in the present moment. Even in the present moment, and the teaching in the explanation says, we are usually vanquished by the present moment. That was the word. How are we vanquished by the present moment? That's a funny word. How are we overtaken by the present moment? And again, it's very similar that we pick it up and we feel like we have to either hold on to it or do something to get rid of it. That it's not okay to just let it be here and recognize it. Oh, this is what's happening right now. So that this is the beginning of the pointing to bring mindfulness, this curiosity about what is this experience happening right now? What is the human experience? What is the emotion that's rising right now? What is the state of mind that's arising right now? What's thoughts that are arising right now? And knowing them as arising in the present moment. Attending to experience with curiosity as opposed to judgment. Attending to experience from the perspective and recognizing something I've been using a lot for myself is, well, this is a human experience. Whatever experience I'm having, somebody somewhere at some point in the history of human species has felt something like this. It is not just about me. This is the nature of being human, that feelings happen, and this is a human experience. This perspective helps us to not like pick it up and own it or take it so personally or feel somehow like we're to blame or that we have something to own here. That it helps us to orient towards this experience in a different way. And so we start to see with this perspective, with mindfulness as a perspective on the presently arisen state, we start to have a different experience around our thoughts, our emotions. And so seeing something like anger arising in the present moment, we start to see, I can know this as a human experience. This is the human experience of anger. And there's a very different feeling when we have mindfulness about something challenging like that than there is if we're caught in that feeling. We may at first, of course, when we start being mindful of our difficult emotions, it's hard to separate from the difficulty. It's hard to separate from the feeling of pain that comes with that emotion. And yet over time, the more we practice it, and in my own experience of this, in my own practice of this, it does not actually take very long before we start to recognize the value of paying attention to difficult states of mind. And so as we see that possibility of being mindful of something challenging or reactive state, we start to see that it gives us some space around it. It creates a condition where it's not as bad as it was when we're just wrapped up in it. It's not as painful for us. And we actually begin to see that there is a little bit more ease, a little bit more space to make skillful choices, a little bit more space to perhaps let it go, set it aside, shift our attention to something else. And so we see the value. We start to see the value of this seeing what's happening in the present moment as something that's happening in the present moment. And so we begin to appreciate that. We begin to appreciate the value of seeing each presently arisen state. And then we may start to see with insight. And insight, you know, there's different kinds of insight. You know, there's insights that we can have about our own personal psychology, let's say. Why... You know, and this is a kind of insight I think we might be more familiar with. That we think about, we reflect back on, why am I reacting to this person? Well, I can see that this person looks kind of similar to that person that was really mean to me. And, you know, that person actually reminded me of that person that was really mean to me. And I can see that, and I can see that I'm relating to this person because of that, the way that person treated me. So we might be able to reflect on these things and see a kind of conditioning or history. And so there's a form of insight in that. There's an understanding that, you know, this relationship here, that we're carrying some baggage into it that may not even be appropriate. And yet often what we see with that kind of reflective understanding is that it doesn't change our relationship to that person, even thinking about it or seeing that it's kind of got, we've seen something, we've understood something through thinking about it. So it's a kind of insight, but often it's not a kind of insight that actually shifts our mind to really have a new relationship with that experience. And then there might be a slightly deeper kind of psychological insight. So for myself, you know, I had a pattern of self-hatred, and I did a lot of therapy around this, and, you know, had some understanding through this kind of reflective practice about what it might be about and how it might have come about, and yet it didn't make the self-hatred go away. Those conversations with that therapist. And then in retreat, as I began exploring the feeling of self-hatred, I saw what I would say is a kind of a psychological understanding of what I had intellectually understood through the therapy. That the thing that the person had proposed to me as being kind of the underlying cause, there was a kind of a seeing into that directly in the present moment. It was kind of like the way I could envision this happening. I don't remember exactly what happened, but, you know, possibly there was a recognition of a thought about the past arising right now, and then seeing how the mind reacted to that thought right now, creating self-hatred right now. So that there was a recognition of the deep connection as it happened. A deep connection to that conditioned history of the pattern of self-hatred. And yet, it was still about my own personal conditioning. And yet, it was a very powerful insight. So that, again, I'd call that still a psychological insight. It was a very powerful insight, and it was powerful enough that I thought, wow, I saw that. I saw into that self-hatred really clearly. I think it's probably not going to happen much anymore. I think I figured that one out. It was just as frequent and just as powerful. So even that kind of understanding didn't really undermine the depth of the pattern. But what that understanding really did do for me, what I'd say is that kind of psychological insight was very powerful in that it made me deeply understand in a very visceral way that it wasn't my fault that I had this feeling of self-hatred, that it was conditioned. It became more the understanding, of course this comes up. This was the situation of the conditioning. Of course this comes up. And so it didn't stop it from coming up, but it created a more of an ease for the mind to be able to see it as a presently arisen state. And so I could really, really watch the arising of self-hatred. And I did on this one retreat. I call it my self-hatred retreat because it just was kind of flooding me over and over again. And just really got to watch it so closely that at some point, this is a kind of a third level of insight, is seeing into the Dharma underpinnings, or the kinds of insights that really undermine our habitual habits and patterns of reactivity and suffering, is insight into the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of what's happening. The impermanent nature of something just being something that comes and goes. The unreliable nature, because things are coming and going, there's nothing that we can say is going to be, this is where I'm gonna figure it out. I'm gonna hold on to this. Because it's just slipping through. There's no way to hold on to anything for very long. And the third, the not self, this was really the insight that undermined that pattern for me in a moment when watching this arising of self-hatred, at some point, the seeing of that happen. It's like the mind saw the shift between no self-hatred and self-hatred coming to be, and understood in that moment that it was completely constructed by this mind, that self-hatred was not something that was somehow like a ball of cancer in my body that was always there, that when I felt it, it was constructed right in that moment, and it was constructed by a thought. And my mind recognized, this is just a thought. And instantly, the mind shifted from self-hatred to bliss. And that moment, essentially seeing the not-self nature of that, that this was just something being constructed. It had no inherent reality. It wasn't something that was always there. It was just being created in this moment because of conditions coming together. So that kind of understandings into impermanent, unreliable, not self, those kinds of insights really begin to shift our relationship to our patterns of suffering. And it is through this being willing to be present for what's arising that the conditions are created, that those kinds of insights happen. We do not make those insights happen. There was no way I could have decided in that moment to see and understand it in that way. It came about because of simply the practice. This is what we can do. This is what we can explore, is just, can we be aware of what is going on in the present moment? Can we not fool ourselves that we are, by reviving the past and constructing the future and believing those future thoughts to be reality, can we actually open to this present moment's arising? So this to me is really, is a teaching where the Buddha pointed us right into the present moment. Right into the present moment. And then he says, today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? Pointing to, my sense of this is pointing to, we don't know how long we have. You know, this reflection on our own mortality is, to me, it's not depressing, actually. It actually reminds me that I have a life in this moment, and what's the best thing that I can do with it while I have it? You know, that it kind of helps me when I reflect on my own mortality. It helps me to really look at what are my priorities? What do I want to do with my life? Is this what I want to be doing with my life? And so this exploration or reflection on our own mortality can be a motivation for not reviving the past and not taking up residence in the future. It can inspire us, I think, and it can help us to, if you reflect regularly on the fact of your own death, and see if it could be not in a depressing way, but just maybe recognizing, and I do this regularly, it's like, yeah, I don't know, today this may be my last day on the planet. So what do I want to do with this day? Because we don't know. I mean, four people yesterday went to work at the UPS headquarters, and that was their last day. We hear this stuff all the time. We hear about it, but we don't take it in as if it could happen to us. Can we actually recognize our own mortality? It can have a huge impact on us. So there's a couple minutes if there's any thoughts or comments or reflections on anything that I've shared or thoughts. Yeah. And then let's get the mic.
Hi, my name is Sandy.
Hi, Sandy.
And I was having conversations with Buddha.
Hold it a little closer here.
I've been having conversations with Buddha a lot lately because a lot is happening with my body.
Mm.
And I asked him for guidance, just simply give me guidance. And where you lead me, I will follow, no questions asked. And so today I woke up and he said, go to this class. And I said, okay. And I looked at the time and I thought, I live down the street, but I don't usually come to the night classes because I don't drive. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go, and people drive crazy. And if I get hit by a car, this will be my last day. And I said, so it may be my last day, it may not be, but I want you to take me quickly in the night while I'm sleeping.
Mm.
I don't want to live through doctor visits and being sick and in the bed, because I've gone through that too.
Yeah.
I've had breast surgery. I've had a stroke. I've had heart disease. Because I was living this crazy life where I was working too many hours and I was in a fast-paced job and I was at the top of my profession and my body just started breaking down.
Yeah.
And that's when I got in touch with Buddha.
Yeah.
And I've been practicing Buddhism and practicing yoga for 20 years, but then I was noticing the both of them and you and him, and I thought they've been in the moment for a long time. I can tell the way she practiced yoga, and he was meditating through your entire hour and a half. And I thought, I've learned so much tonight, and you, both of you, you have such a strong will and guidance in this profession, your voice. And I was in the class before this, the meditating class, And she was so inspiring. She was just so beautiful. I'll be thinking about her all night. Mm. And then you mentioned a book I haven't been reading lately, and I used to read Thich Nhat Hanh all the time. And so now you're having this reading, and I thought, God, Buddha, you gave me exactly the guidance that I needed.
Beautiful. And you know, sometimes it takes suffering for us to find it. That's what it took.
I totally believe that.
That is what it took. And I'm so, in some ways, I'm so grateful for that.
I am too.
Yeah, so.
Because it didn't kill me. It made me stronger.
So thank you.
Thank you.
And it's time to stop, so thank you.